On behalf of the Park School of Communications and the Park Center for Independent Media, I want to welcome you all to the 9th Annual Izzy Award Ceremony. I'm Jeff Cohen. Ithaca is a community that values independent journalism. I'm Jeff Cohen, the director of the Park Center for Independent Media. Quick thank yous. I want to thank Diane Gajewski, the dean of the Park School of Communications, who's been so supportive of our center. Is Diane in the room? Yes. And I want to thank the Park Foundation, without whom there would be no center. And that's Adelaide Park Gomer. Adelaide, wave. The Park Foundation may be the best friend independent journalists have in our country. These are the Izzys, not the Emmys, not the Tonys or the Grammys. No tuxes, no gowns, no red carpet. No giving the award to the wrong people. We have no band to play our award winners off the stage if the acceptance speech goes beyond 55 seconds, because the whole purpose of this night is to learn about the work of our honorees, who are some of the best journalists operating in our country today. We want to hear how they produced the stories that they did. We want to perhaps hear why mainstream media so often missed these stories. Our award is named in memory of I.F. Izzy Stone, the dissident legendary journalist who for decades scooped the mainstream media of his day, because Izzy was not gullible. Izzy was an independent who had no corporate sponsors or owners censoring him, but most of all, Izzy had heart. And like all of our award winners today who do journalism on behalf of and with the oppressed, the poor, the disenfranchised, the marginalized, the immigrant, the prisoner. From the beginning, our award has been supported by Izzy Stone's family, especially Izzy's elder son, Jeremy Stone, who has spoken at two of these award ceremonies. We dedicate tonight's ceremony to Jeremy, who passed away in January of 81. Thanks to Jeremy that Ithaca College is the repository of Izzy Stone's memorabilia. We have all of his weeklies. We have all of his books. We have his passports. We have the newspaper that Izzy started when he was 14 years old. We have the personal letters of praise to Izzy from people like Bertrand Russell, Eleanor Roosevelt, Albert Einstein. We have the $5 subscription check written by Albert Einstein for I.F. Stone's Weekly. We even have Izzy's 1940s Underwood typewriter. For people under 30, let me define typewriter. An archaic machine that printed letters one character at a time on paper that you insert on a roller. Jeremy Stone was a mathematician and a force for peace and diplomacy in his own right, as the head of the Federation of American Scientists for 30 years. We have a president today who despises independent journalism and is sometimes compared to President Richard Nixon. And the Nixon administration compiled an enemies list full of dozens of journalists and activists and advocates that were feared by Nixon's White House. Jeremy Stone sometimes operated in the shadows of his dad, but it was Jeremy Stone, not Izzy Stone, that found his name on Nixon's enemies list. So may he rest in peace. This was a banner year for independent media covering stories that mainstream media largely missed, from Standing Rock in North Dakota to the economic hopelessness of the Rust Belt to the impeachability of President Trump for receiving private business benefits in violation of the U.S. Constitution. And there were several independent journalists and filmmakers whose work stood above in clarity, in bravery, in forcing issues to be discussed that were previously ignored. These journalists focused on private prison profiteers and their victims, on immigrants' rights, on attacks on voting rights, environmental racism, racial discrimination in housing, education, criminal justice. Without further ado, to present our very first award, let's bring up the independent journalist and author and the recently retired associate director of the Park Center for Independent Media, Maura Stevens.
Ari Berman. And relentless in pursuing stories on the many aspects of voter suppression, such as gutting the Voting Rights Act, imposing ID laws, closing polling places, and redrawing district maps, and their devastating effects on individuals, and especially on racial and ethnic minorities. Let's watch this briefing to Congress that he gave just 8 days after the election.
An honor to be here. Thank you to the Congressional Voting Rights Caucus. Thank you to Representative VC, and thank you for everyone in this room for coming. We need a new voting rights movement in this country now more than ever, and it's great to see so many people here to begin that. So I covered voter suppression in a bunch of different states and wrote dozens and dozens and dozens of stories about this. And I really believe that the attack on voting rights was the biggest missed story of the 2016 election. There were 26 presidential debates, but not a single question about the fact that this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. What did that mean in practice? 14 states had new voting restrictions in effect for the first time in 2016. And we saw lots of different examples of the impact. States like Texas, even when the courts ruled that strict voter ID was no longer required, poll workers were asking for it. In North Carolina, even after the federal courts ruled that cuts to early voting target black voters with almost surgical precision, that they were as close to a smoking gun as you'll ever see in modern times. Even after that, Republicans in North Carolina cut early voting, reduced polling places, and that led to longer lines and people being turned away. And I just want to tell one really quick story about this that I saw in Wisconsin. Because everyone says, what's the big deal? Everybody can vote. Everyone has ID. Nobody's impacted by this stuff. So I just want to tell one quick story that I encountered in Wisconsin. I told a lot of these stories, but this one really stuck with me. I wrote about a 58-year-old African-American man by the name of Eddie Lee Holloway Jr., who moved from Chicago to Milwaukee. He wanted to be able to vote, so he brought his Illinois state ID, his Social Security card, and his birth certificate with him to the DMV in Milwaukee. He was not issued an ID because his name was Eddie Lee Holloway Jr., but the name on his birth certificate said Eddie Jr. Holloway instead. So he had the right first name, the right last name. He had supporting documentation, but he wasn't given an ID. He was told to go to Vital Records downtown in Milwaukee. He went to Vital Records, and they asked him, he said, how much will it cost for me to get an ID for voting? They said between $400 and $600 to amend your birth certificate. Then he went back to Illinois, where he was from, and he went to Vital Records there, and he said, I want to amend my birth certificate. They said, we need to see your high school and your vaccination records. He went from Springfield, the state capital, to Decatur, where he was from, got his high school records, went back to Vital Records in Illinois, and said, can I get my birth certificate amended? They said, no, we need your full Social Security statement. He went back to Milwaukee. He got all his documents. He emailed Vital Records in Illinois. He said, can I give you this information over fax or email? They said, no, you have to come back in person. And at this point, he gave up. The net effect was this one man, Eddie Lee Holloway Jr., made 7 trips to different public agencies in 2 different states, spent over $200 of his own money, and still was not able to vote in Wisconsin. And I called his lawyer, because a lot of this came from a deposition he gave under oath to the ACLU, and I called his lawyer 3 days before the election. I said, whatever happened to Eddie Lee Holloway Jr.? Did he get his ID to vote? His lawyer told me he was so disgusted he moved back to Illinois.
No.
So did voter suppression have an impact? Absolutely. I told these stories. But even if it had no impact, the fact that one party deliberately made it harder to vote was an unbelievable scandal that needed far more attention.
And that is just one of scores of stories of individuals that Ari Berman told. Please join me in welcoming him and presenting him with this Izzy Award. Ari Berman. The courageous spirit. The courageous spirit of IF Izzy Stone is alive and thriving in the tireless journalism of Ari Berman.
Sorry, Jews can get emotional at these kind of things. I want to thank the Park Center, thank Ithaca College, and thank everyone who's coming here. This award is particularly meaningful for me, and the reason why I got a little emotional is because I.F. Stone was Washington editor of The Nation from 1940 to 1946. So not only is he recognized as this unbelievable figure, but you know he has a personal connection to the publication that I've worked for over a decade. So it's particularly meaningful to get an award named after I.F. Stone if you're affiliated with The Nation. So this issue of voting rights was honestly something that I kind of stumbled upon. I had been covering American politics broadly, and I noticed following the 2010 election, when a bunch of states flipped from blue to red or became a whole lot redder, that there was a wave of new voting restrictions that were being introduced in state after state, that from 2011 to 2012, there were 180 new voting restrictions introduced in 41 states, and that half the states in the country changed their election laws to make it harder to vote. And the issue wasn't getting any attention. It was being buried in places like the New York Times, the Washington Post. It was maybe being covered in some local news places, but no one had really put together that this was a national strategy launched by Republicans in reaction to the election of the first black president. So I pitched a story about it originally to Rolling Stone. I'm not sure if that qualifies as independent media, but it was certainly a sister publication at the very least. I pitched a story to Rolling Stone about it, honestly without really knowing that much about the topic, which I do not encourage young journalists to do. But to my surprise, they commissioned the piece, and then I kind of became an expert on this topic. And I published a story about it in August 2011 in Rolling Stone called The GOP War on Voting, which laid out that this was a national strategy that had been launched by Republicans that was taking place in state after state after state. And then after I wrote this one article, The Nation, where I was on staff, encouraged me to make it a full-time beat.
because a lot of stuff leading up to the 2012 election had begun to happen. There were lawsuits filed, there were new restrictions passed, and this was an issue all the way through the 2012 election, where you may remember in states like Florida, there were five-hour lines to vote because that state cut early voting and eliminated early voting on the Sunday before the election when black churches held souls to the polls, voter mobilization drives. And on election night 2012, when he was reelected, Barack Obama said, we have to fix that, talking about our electoral system. But we didn't fix the problem. In fact, the problem got worse. Because after the 2012 election, in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act and ruled that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And when that case, which was called Shelby County versus Holder, was first heard, I began asking people I knew who were lawyers and academics and voting rights experts, what should I read to get up to speed on the Voting Rights Act? What did it do? Why is it being challenged nearly 50 years after its passage? And I was surprised that no one had really written a definitive account of what the Voting Rights Act did and accomplished. There had been so much written about the events that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. Bloody Sunday in Selma, Mississippi Freedom Summer, all of the work of the civil rights movement that culminated in the passage of the Voting Rights Act, but there had been so much less written about what happened after 1965. And I thought it was critically important to link the struggles of the 1960s with the struggles that were occurring in the present day. So that's what led me to really write my book, Give Us the Ballot, and to intensify my reporting when it came to voting rights. And John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, in his majority opinion, said, history did not end in 1965. Talking about why the Voting Rights Act was outdated. But I also knew from my own reporting and my own research that voter suppression didn't end in 1965 either. And that I was really committed to showing that voter suppression was not a thing of the past, that the Voting Rights Act was not frozen in time, but that these things still really mattered today. So I just want to talk briefly about what has happened since that Supreme Court decision. The first thing that happened is that laws that were actually blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, where you could vote with a gun permit but not a student ID, were allowed to go into effect. Just this week, that law was blocked for the fifth time in federal court. But if the Supreme Court hadn't gutted the Voting Rights Act, that law never would have been in effect in the first place, because Texas was one of those states that had to approve its voting changes with the federal government. The second thing that happened is states passed more sweeping voting restrictions. North Carolina didn't just require voter ID, which gets all the headlines. They cut early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They even eliminated Citizens Awareness Month, which the state ran to encourage people to register to vote. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in a remarkable opinion last year, said that the law targeted black voters, in the court's words, with almost surgical precision. And they said that some parts of the law were as close to a smoking gun as you'll ever see in modern times. And they gave one example. North Carolina eliminated voting on the Sundays before the election, just like Florida did in 2012 to devastating effect. Sundays in states that have early voting, unfortunately New York doesn't have early voting, and we'll get to that, but in states that have early voting, Sunday is a very convenient day to vote because a lot of people aren't working, and that's also when black churches tend to hold souls to the polls voter mobilization drives. So the court asked North Carolina, why did you cut early voting? And North Carolina said, well, some counties were using it more than others. And the court said, okay, well, which counties? And North Carolina said, well, counties that had a larger African-American population and that tended to vote Democratic. And the federal court said, you just admitted to us in federal court that you did this to discriminate against people based on their party, but more importantly, based on their race. And so to read this opinion about how North Carolina intentionally discriminated against voters of color in the year 2016, not 1966, not 1866, in 2016 is really remarkable. And then what also happened is that the voter suppression that we identify with the South, with places like Texas, with places like North Carolina and Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi, it spread north to states like Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania that did not have the same history when it came to voter suppression. And I was in Wisconsin on Election Day, and I saw the impact of these laws, not just the story that I told of Eddie Lee Holloway Jr., but dozens and dozens and dozens of stories like that. And Wisconsin was one of those states that had a strict voter ID law, and according to federal courts, 300,000 registered voters did not have these strict forms of ID that were required, which was 9% of the electorate. And Donald Trump only won the state by 20,000 votes. So when I talked in my testimony for Congress about the fact that this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act, that there were 26 debates, but not a single question about the gutting of voting rights, what's so alarming to me is that this was an election year in which we spent hours and hours and hours and hours talking about polls and who people were going to vote for. But we didn't ask the most fundamental question: would they be able to vote in the first place? And I am worried that tens of thousands of people were turned away from the polls because of these kind of laws, and it didn't get nearly the attention that it deserved. Now my concern is that the problem is going to get worse. Because when Donald Trump says that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally, it's not just about his bruised ego. It's not just about another wild conspiracy theory. He is laying the groundwork for massive voter suppression by his party as the president of the United States, which is really something we've never seen before, much worse than Nixon or Reagan or anyone coming before him in terms of doing this. And it's unfortunate because there's so much we could be doing to make it easier for people to vote. There's so much we could be doing to bring more people into the political process. Oregon, for example, just became the first state to pass automatic registration. So if you go to the DMV in Oregon and they can confirm that you are a resident of Oregon, that you're over 18, that you're a U.S. citizen, they will automatically register you to vote. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say, I want to register to vote. They will mail you a voter registration card in the mail within 3 weeks, and you're registered to vote. And then because Oregon's a vote-by-mail state, they'll also send you a ballot afterwards. Oregon registered 300,000 people this way. So while 300,000 people were being turned away from the polls in Wisconsin, 300,000 people were being automatically registered to vote in Oregon. And to me, this is the wave of the future. And we need this not just in Oregon, and we need this not just in states like Texas that are suppressing the vote, we need this in states like New York also, supposedly progressive states that don't have early voting, that don't have Election Day registration, that don't have all of these voting reforms that states across the country are trying to implement. So I fear that when it comes to voting, we're having the entirely wrong debate in this country. We're continually talking about voter fraud without any evidence of fraud, and we're talking about laws that turn people away from the ballot as opposed to how we can bring more people into the political process, how we can change a situation where a quarter of Americans still aren't even registered to vote. They weren't contacted by any political campaigns. They didn't show up in any polls. 60 million eligible Americans still aren't even registered to vote in this country. And I think it's that kind of thing that we really should be doing something about. And I don't think you can view the attack on voting rights in a vacuum. I believe that Donald Trump is the greatest threat to democracy in our lifetime, and that all of the attacks on democracy are connected. The attack on voting rights, the attack on a free press, the attack on an independent judiciary, the unbelievable amount of secret dark money that is flowing into our political system, the hacking of our elections by a foreign adversary. I think all of this stuff is connected, and I think all of it speaks to the vital importance of an independent media and of a free press. Because I just read a week ago a very alarming piece in the New York Times Magazine about Jeff Zucker, the president of CNN. I'm not sure how many of you read it, but I'd recommend reading it for a window into what the people who are making news think. And Jeff Zucker said he wanted politics to be covered like a sport. He wanted CNN to be like ESPN. And I love ESPN as much as anybody. My wife will be the first person to tell you that. But the last thing we need to do is treat politics as a sport. As Shane, as Seth, as all of the American divided people have shown, people's lives are at stake here. Our democracy is at stake here. This is not a game. This is deadly serious. And that's why we need independent media, why we need the nation, why we need Mother Jones, why we need America Divided, why we need the Park Center, why we need these institutions. They are more vital than ever. So thank you for honoring our work.
Our next Izzy Award winner, Seth Fried Wessler, uncovered appalling stories of people abandoned to neglect and death in a shadowy sector of the U.S. prison system, private prison system. Here he is speaking with Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, whom I'm sure you all know, on Democracy Now! Last February.
We turn now to a shocking new investigation about private prisons and the dozens of men who have died in disturbing circumstances inside these facilities in recent years. The investigation, published in Nation magazine this month, documents more than 100 deaths at private, immigrant-only prisons since 1998. The investigation's author, Seth Fried Wessler, spent more than 2 years fighting in and out of court to obtain more than 9,000 pages of medical records that private prison contractors had submitted to the Bureau of Prisons. The documents are stunning. They reveal more than 24 cases of inadequate medical care that independent doctors say contributed to the premature deaths of the prisoners. One man died shackled to his bed from an undiagnosed HIV-related infection in his brain. Other men died from lack of medical care for cancer and liver disease. Several men were denied adequate mental health treatment and went on to commit suicide.
This comes as the Democratic presidential candidates are increasingly speaking out against multimillion-dollar private prison contracts. In September, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a bill to ban government contracts with private prison companies at the federal, state, and local level within 3 years. In October, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also pledged to ban the use of private prison companies. The Clinton campaign later said it would stop accepting money from lobbying groups linked to private prisons and that it would donate the money it had already received. Well, to talk about this and more, we're joined by the author of the new investigation, Seth Fried Wessler, reporter with the Investigative Fund, his new story for The Nation called This Man Will Almost Certainly Die. Seth, welcome to Democracy Now! Explain the title, This Man Will Almost Certainly Die.
That title comes from a quote that was left in one of the medical files I obtained through an open records request. I obtained 9,000 pages of documents. And in those documents from one of these prisons, there was a medical doctor who left his normal medical notes, but he also left a series of notes railing against the system that he worked in inside of one of these private federal prisons. Private federal prisons used only to hold non-citizens convicted of federal crime, a sort of segregated system of prisons. In these files, he left a series of notes where he was railing against this prison system, basically saying that it wasn't providing prisoners, or wasn't allowing him to provide prisoners the kind of care that, as a medical doctor, he believed he should be able to provide. These records tell the stories of 103 men who died inside this federal subsystem of prisons. Private prisons in general, they have existed for decades, but it took until the late 90s, for the Bureau of Prisons to begin privatizing. The Bureau of Prisons had resisted privatization until the late 90s, when the Clinton administration proposed in its 1996 budget request a plan to privatize a subset of federal prisons to see if, in fact, they could save money. This was a time when the Clinton administration was promising not to expand the size of the federal workforce, but also prisons were growing. So
when prisons grow, federal prisons grow, usually that means more workers. The solution they found was to privatize federal prisons. Well, very soon, as these prisons started to open, the federal government began to incarcerate only non-citizens inside of most of its federal prisons that have been privatized.
But you've also noted that a lot of the people that are incarcerated are basically the crimes they've committed is reentry into the United States, not necessarily
an actual crime
here in the U.S.
That's right. In fact, 40% of the people inside of these prisons are incarcerated for the criminal offense of crossing over the border. In the early 90s, 4,000 people were prosecuted criminally for crossing over the border. By 2013, at the peak of these prosecutions under the Obama administration, 91,000 people were prosecuted criminally for illegal entry or illegal reentry, for crossing the border, something we usually think of as a civil offense. Usually people are detained and deported as a result of crossing the border without papers. But we've started to incarcerate, sometimes for years, tens of thousands of
Please, another warm welcome for Izzy Award winner Seth Fried Wessler.
Thank you all. I'm really thrilled to be here, incredibly honored to be receiving this award along with these other journalists and storytellers who I respect so much. Thank you to the Park Foundation and the Park Center. Really, really honored to be here. 5 years ago, almost exactly now, in 2012, I got a phone call from a woman in California who told me that her brother had been a prisoner in a federal prison in Mississippi, and that he had died there following a protracted period of pretty intense medical neglect, that he had complained about increasing pain, he had been vomiting blood, and he had gone back to the clinic in this prison repeatedly. And each time he had visited this clinic, he had been sent back to his room and told to take an ibuprofen or a Tylenol until this pain and this illness got worse and worse and worse, and he died. As a reporter who for a long time has written about federal law enforcement, about immigration enforcement, federal prisons, the justice system, these kinds of calls and letters and people reaching out with these kinds of stories, it's a terribly rare thing to happen. It happens all the time. And as a reporter, it can be hard to figure out what to pursue, when to pursue these stories, how to pursue these stories. But at the very same time that this woman in California called me to tell me that her brother had died in a federal prison, that same federal prison suddenly made national news because inmates in that prison had erupted in what major press outlets were reporting as a serious and historically rare prison riot. Prisoners had erupted into violence, 20 people were injured, a guard was killed in the chaos that ensued, and the prison officials blamed the riot on gang fights, internal gang strife inside of this prison. So I called this woman who had called me from California back up, and she began to tell me a different story about what was happening inside of this prison. She said that her brother had told her that prisoners inside had long been very upset about the conditions of their confinement, that they had been denied medical care, and that they had been repeatedly mistreated by guards, that there was deep kind of racism built into the functioning of this prison, and that for years people inside of this prison had been organizing, and that organizing had led to a protest which turned into a riot and became violent. And I began to sort of look into these prisons a little bit more, and what I found was that this prison in Mississippi, this federal prison in Mississippi, a place called the Adams County Correctional Center, was this sort of strange kind of federal prison, a federal prison that had been privatized, been contracted out to, in this case, a company then called the Corrections Corporation of America, and that it was one of, at the time, 14 federal criminal prisons that were part of the Bureau of Prison System that had been privatized completely, were run by groups like CCA and the GEO Group and Management and Training Corporation, and that were used exclusively to hold people who are non-citizens. That these prisons were, in fact, segregated on the basis of people's citizenship. And that the federal government, in documents and later statements to me, but already, had said quite clearly that these prisons make sense for non-citizens because non-citizens do not have to be provided the same kinds of services, the same kinds of programs and services that citizens do, because non-citizens will later be deported. So we don't have to try to rehabilitate them. We don't have to do much for them. A kind of warehousing makes sense for this population because they're just going to be sent back somewhere else. And so this prison system, which sort of began in the federal system in the late 90s, was actually set up explicitly to function under less stringent rules than the rest of the prison system. So if I were convicted of a federal crime as a U.S. citizen, I would go to a normal federal prison. There are some not far from here. But non-citizens go to these different prisons, and these different prisons, their contracts, the contracts that the companies sign with the federal government, don't require them to follow the same standards and rules that other federal prisons are required to follow, including the rules that govern medical care, the staffing of prisons, the kinds of workers who are supposed to be hired. And so I decided I wanted to dig into what was happening in these prisons, not only because I was now hearing more stories of neglect, but also because these facilities, these 14 facilities, unlike nearly every other low-security federal prison in the United States, continued to erupt in these major protests that were described as riots and were always blamed on internal gang strife. So after I received this call and did other work for a while and tried to dig around, I filed what at the time I sort of thought of as a wholly aspirational Freedom of Information Act request. It was like, you know, 15 pages long, and I asked for every document about everything that the federal government might have about these prisons, expecting that I might get something, that I might be able to know something about what was happening inside of these facilities. And I waited a year talking to a very nice FOIA officer in D.C. who told me repeatedly that, no, they're coming. You'll get the documents soon. And I did other work. And they never came. And so in 2014, I filed, with the help of an attorney working on a pro bono basis, a federal lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons. And through that lawsuit, as a result of that lawsuit, the Bureau of Prisons released to me 30,000 pages of records from these prisons. And in this pile of paper were the stories of dozens of men, all of the people in these prisons are men, who had died well incarcerated in this subsystem of federal prisons. And then working with a group of a couple of dozen medical doctors, internists, family doctors, psychiatrists, we began to pull through these records, and we constructed a sort of research study. We wanted to sort of look into how these people had died. And what we found, looking at these documents, was that over and over again, in dozens of cases, men held in these facilities had died of clearly preventable, treatable diseases, had died as a result of the abject failure of these institutions to provide people with, in some cases, any medical care at all. And that was happening in significant part because the federal government's contracts, laying out how these prisons were supposed to operate, didn't require these prisons to follow the same kinds of rules that require regular federal prisons to treat prisoners in a certain kind of way. We found that men held in these facilities were being treated by vastly understaffed medical departments, prisons operating without a single medical doctor around for years on end, that they were handing over the basic operation of medical care and intake and evaluation to licensed practical nurses who have about a year of training and are really meant to support mid-level providers and doctors in the provision of medical care, that they were acting as doctors, that people were returning, just as this man whose sister called me, returning to the clinics over and over again and not receiving any care at all. I found in these files the case of a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, who's a man who arrived in this prison called Reeves in West Texas, a GEO Group-run prison. And when he arrived there, that particular prison had just gone through a series of two major prison riots. In just weeks earlier, prisoners who had been protesting the deaths of several prisoners had been organizing, and that organizing had turned into this riot, and facilities were lit on fire. And he arrived there, and he began right away to complain of terrible, terrible back pain and headaches and other pain. And he returned about 20 times to the clinic over a period of a year and was seen only by these low-level medical providers who every time sent him back to his cell and told him to take some Tylenol or ibuprofen until one day he collapsed outright on the rec yard and was pulled into the clinic. The doctor was called. The doctor said, "You should send this guy to the hospital." They sent him to the hospital and immediately was provided an HIV test. He had full-blown AIDS and serious infections related to the AIDS, to his AIDS diagnosis, and he died 3 days later as a result of those illnesses. The doctors who read this file, looking at the notes that these nurses had left, they said quite clearly that this was a case where, had this person been provided care when he arrived in this prison, this death could have been prevented. But this prison wasn't following the Bureau of Prisons rules that would require that he be tested for HIV when he arrived. So this man didn't receive that kind of care, and he died as a result. Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, like many of the people in this prison and others like it, was incarcerated for the act of crossing back over the United States border after having been previously deported. As I said in that clip, the crime of border crossing didn't used to be considered a criminal offense, has become the most prosecuted federal crime in the United States. It has expanded the size of our federal court system. It has fueled the growth of the federal prison system, and in particular, this privatized, separate on the basis of citizenship, and in many ways unequal system of federal prisons. I continued to dig into what was happening in these prisons, and another batch of 20,000 pages of records arrived. And I opened up these emails that had attachments, and what I found were troves of documents, of monitoring reports, from federal officials whose job it was to go into these facilities and note what was happening inside, to monitor whether these prisons were functioning in the way that the contracts required them to. And over again, those monitors found vast and overwhelming deficiencies in the provision of medical care, in fact, of the very kinds that I had documented. In fact, these very monitors had made notes of deaths that had occurred that I had already written about, and for years had been noting these deaths and had been warning the facilities, if you do not fix this problem, we will punish you, we will take away some of the money that we pay you, you may even be closed down. And year after year, more people died in exactly the same ways. In fact, some of those officials tried to have these prisons closed down. They went to Washington, these monitors, they went to their bosses in Washington, and they said, we need these prisons to be shut down. And repeatedly, these monitors, whose job it was to watch over these contract prisons, were told, no, we can't close these prisons down. We need them for their space. In August of this past year, the Department of Justice, in early August, made the decision to close down one of the prisons that I had written about, the Cibola County Correctional Center. It was really the worst of the prisons I had written about. It was the focus of a second story. And a week after that move to close down, to begin a process of closing down all privatized federal criminal facilities. We thought that that process was going to move forward. About a month after the Department of Justice ordered the BOP to close down these facilities, before the election, Cibola County was recontracted to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a different federal agency, to be used to hold immigrants on civil charges. And then Donald Trump won the election, and Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, reversed this order. Last week, Jeff Sessions ordered his federal prosecutors to make the prosecution of immigrants a priority. It was already the most prosecuted federal crime, to make these prosecutions a priority. And so, this administration that has supported private prisons has also decided to continue and ramp up the kinds of prosecutions that filled these specific federal private prisons. 2 weeks ago, after the election, I got a call from another sister of a man held in one of these facilities. This one, the Big Spring Correctional Center, a GEO Group-run facility in West Texas, who said to me, "We thought that these prisons were going to be shut down. We thought my brother was going to be removed from this prison. It looks like that's not going to happen. This is what's been happening in this prison. I think you need to look into this." So this story doesn't go anywhere for the time being. Thank you.
Our next Izzy Award winner is Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer, who also investigated abuses in the for-profit prison system, and he did it by getting inside, literally.
This prison is crazy. Beyond anything I ever imagined. To be honest with you, I didn't think it was going to happen. It was just kind of a whim. I put in an application with the Corrections Corporation of America for prison guard jobs. A week later, I start getting calls. I'm surprised how quickly it happened.
I don't know how long I'm going to be doing this. I don't know where it's going to take me. I don't know what my job will entail.
This company and these big private prison companies in general are kind of notoriously secretive.
Corrections Corporation of America began around 1983.
CCA, the GEO Group, and MTC operate more than 130 facilities nationwide.
The combined revenues of these two companies reached $3.3 billion in 2014.
It's very hard for journalists to get information about these prisons.
Are you aware that they were lobbyists for Corrections Corporation of America?
Officials wouldn't say what started the riot.
Are they as safe? Are they under the same standards?
A riot broke out today.
Guards looked on but didn't do anything.
Four inmates are dead.
Eight inmates hospitalized.
46 prisoners ended up needing medical attention.
We are America's leader in partnership corrections. We are CCA.
The first time that I went in there, I mean, I was very nervous.
I almost had a heart attack like 5 times, yeah. It's gonna be hard to adjust to. I just wanted to get out like as soon as I could, and I was in there for like a half hour. Soon I'm gonna be in there for 8 hours a day, and then soon after that I'm gonna be in there for 12 hours a day. Oh, God. Love you too.
Today was the end of my third week, and I got my first paycheck. The paycheck, which is for 2 weeks of work, is for $587. I honestly do not know how somebody lives on that wage here.
Turnover was just awful.
One of the main reasons why we can't keep anybody here is because you're paying piss. Ask your damn bean counters why nobody wants to stay. Between the danger level, the bullshit we got to put up with from the ivory tower, and the lack of a living wage, nobody's going to put up with this shit forever.
I'm pissed right now. I just left the prison, and on my way out, I was stopped and told that I had to come in tomorrow. I told them I'm not coming. Doing this job exhausted is really stupid. Spoke for a while with an inmate who had no legs and no fingers. He had legs and fingers a year ago, but he lost them when he got gangrene in the prison.
Gangrene. Mr. Scott complained about that for months to the medical staff at Wynn. They gave him the equivalent of a couple of Motrin and told him to go away.
Never saw a doctor. All the time.
He's now suing the prison.
Shane's article rocked the Corrections Corporation of America and its stock price, which rebranded itself as CoreCivic. Along with Seth Wessler's work, it helped move the Obama Justice Department away from private prisons. But Shane Bauer wasn't satisfied just for getting inside a prison to do an undercover investigation. He also went undercover on the U.S.-Mexico border, and we have a short video clip.
We have, throughout the country, groups of armed men, mostly white men, that see themselves as a defense against the federal government.
Armed protesters are vowing to occupy a federal building in Oregon for as long as it takes.
Three members of a right-wing militia were arrested.
Armed supporters pointing guns at federal law enforcement officers.
A lot of these militias were born basically after Obama got elected. The initial movement in the 90s died down after George Bush was elected, and as soon as we elected the first black president, membership skyrocketed. When I set up my Facebook page and whenever I reach out to these guys, I use my real name. Had they Googled me, they would have seen that I was a senior reporter at Mother Jones, and they probably would not have allowed me into their organization. There's armed guards at the base, guys with AR-15s kind of patrolling it. I just kind of rolled up, had my camo on. They didn't really ask any questions. These guys were really amped up. And a lot of them were military veterans that had served in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was always worried when I was out on these things that we're going to actually run into somebody. My understanding was that if we did run into somebody, we were to call the base, and the base would call the Border Patrol. We're not supposed to shoot anybody unless somebody shoots at us. But when we're going out on these operations, guys are talking about hunting Mexicans. I mean, the stuff they're saying is like, It's not hard to imagine a situation in which they're shooting somebody.
If I can slay me a body today, I'll be f***ing happy.
What's that?
If I can slay me a body today, I'll be f***ing happy.
Like, pretty constant, the things that they would say about Mexicans and black people.
Let's bring up Izzy Award winner Shane Bauer.
Thank you. It's a huge honor to be here. And I was just thinking, sitting here, that, a couple years ago, when I kind of set out on this prison project, I never thought that that was going to work out, let alone be receiving the Izzy Stone Award for this work. You know, I just want to start by giving some of the background on why I did this. I mean, why I took this approach. I had been reporting on prisons for a few years. I had spent a couple years in prison myself in Iran. I was living in Damascus at the time, working as a journalist, and took a trip to northern Iraq with some friends, and we unknowingly came near the Iran-Iraq border and were captured and held for 2 years. I spent 4 months in solitary confinement, the rest of the time in a cell with one other person, mostly cut off from the rest of the world. And then when I got out, all of my career up to that point had been in the Middle East, and I got out and I heard about a hunger strike that was happening in California prisons, involving thousands of prisoners protesting the use of long-term solitary confinement. And I didn't know about this. I didn't know that we had 80,000 people in solitary confinement in the United States, that we have thousands of them have been in for more than 10 years, some 20 or 30 or 40 years. And, you know, after I was out for months and was kind of readjusting, I started digging into that and looking at people's cases, and eventually visited a prison and did kind of expose on that for Mother Jones. And I always thought I would go back to the Middle East, but I just kept kind of never being able to pull away from prisons. And you know, the world of prisons in this country is so vast. I mean, we have more than 2 million people behind bars, far more than any country in the world. And the more that I did this work, the more that I realized that it's a really closed world. The barrier between us and the inside of these prisons is very high, and it's gotten higher as time has gone on. Back in the 70s, you know, when it was completely accepted for guards to just beat prisoners, journalists could go to prisons. It wasn't that hard. You know, you could go in. There were people that went in day after day, and that's changed. That with our prison system boomed, it's just, you know, skyrocketed since the 1970s, and along that, you know, prisons became more secretive. And, I learned that I'd done records requests using, you know, state laws to get access to public records, and often I could not get those records unless I sued. And, you know, it's tedious. It takes a lot of time and a lot of money. And when you do win that stuff, a lot of times you just get, a spreadsheet. You just have this little bit of data to kind of try to sift through, which is why Seth's work was so incredible, because he really got something massive, which is really rare. And, you know, I had been interested in private prisons. I'd kind of poked around at them, but it was hard to really get at that story, because on top of the normal barrier to prison, there's a higher barrier with private prisons. You know, these are companies, so a lot of the public access laws don't apply.
These companies have lobbied to prevent, to kill bills that would require them to give at least as much access as the publicly run prisons. So, you know, generally when we hear about them, it's kind of like there's, you know, a riot and they pop up in the news, or we dig through civil rights lawsuits and piece together what we can. So I wanted to really see what it was like inside. The system controls, there's about 130,000 people in private prisons in this country right now. And I wanted to see what life was like inside of them. So I, you know, got this job. I applied for the job. Really, I was honestly just bored at work one afternoon and just thought I'd fill out the application. I talked to my editors about it, you know, and they said, yeah, go for it. Just don't lie about anything. But it was kind of this thing that was like, this isn't going to really happen, you know. I don't think any of us really thought it was going to go anywhere, but give it a try. And then next thing I know, I was talking to people who were interviewing me, but really they were trying to convince me to take a job. You know, they were, you know, before I went into these interviews, I was nervous because then I'm thinking, okay, I've gotten past this hurdle where they now want to talk to me, but what do I say to them? You know, I mean, I'm not going to lie to them, so what do I do? So I just went for it, and lucky for me, they didn't ask me I wanted to work in a prison. They didn't ask me anything about my job history. They told me, you know, the person I talked to in Louisiana told me that, you know, people like to squirrel hunt around there, so and fish, you know, so if I was into that, she was trying to come up with what she could, and she didn't have a lot to work with because the job was $9 an hour, you know. And so I took this job, and something that, you know, just that I want to touch on really quick is that the thing that is that I think really is the most significant aspect of winning this award is that, you know, we've been for about 20, 30 years, we've had a kind of hiatus in this type of reporting. We have a very rich history in this country of undercover reporting that, you know, the possibility, you know, journalism institutions would reserve this tool for when there was no other way to get a story. And lawsuits and really put, you know, created a lot of fear about that, especially a Food Lion case against ABC News. And the culture really shifted around it, and part of what went along with that was that the kind of the whole awards regime stopped recognizing undercover reporting. It was just, if you're undercover reporting, you don't, you know, you don't qualify, and that is changing, you know. I think that in this time where the media is really under attack, it's really important. For just this to recognize that this is a valid approach, and that more importantly, that institutions that impact thousands of people do not have the last say in what the public is to see. And, you know, this is the framework that we've been dealing with, where these institutions, you know, will say, no, you can't come in, and that's it. When I was in the prison, you know, guards would say to me, my work partner said to me once that I wish an undercover reporter would come, or an investigative reporter would come and investigate this prison. And I couldn't say anything to him, but he was pretty excited when he found out. One aspect of this, of taking this approach that was interesting to me, was thinking about, you know, how as investigative journalists we always want the documents, and that's the thing that's really hard to get. That's the thing that Seth got. But the documents, a lot of the times, are wrong. You know, so I saw this in the prison. You know, where, so for example, there was a really high level of violence. It was much higher than the maximum security prison, Angola prison. People are getting stabbed every week. And I would, you know, while I'm in there, I'm trying to capture scenes. You know, I'm looking for interesting events, bits of dialogue to create a really rich story. But I'm also doing the kind of stuff that we think of as more the kind of typical investigative work of getting the data, counting, you know, just getting the raw information. And one of the things I did was record whenever there's a stabbing. And when I left, I did a records request with the Department of Corrections. And you know, this is kind of a little detail in the story that probably most people that read it didn't even notice. But it's significant because, you know, when I got that information from the Department of Corrections on the number of stabbings, which the company is required to report, the number of stabbings that I recorded in a two-month period were 10 stabbings in 2 months. The prison reported 5 stabbings in 10 months. So, you know, even going through that work and getting those documents, I would never know that those stabbings occurred, you know, had I not been there. There was also a culture of, you know, record keeping that kind of protected the company that, you know, people who worked there, it's not like they... Honestly, I mean, everybody I met that worked there hated the company, and prisoners and guards really bonded on that. But still, it's just, you know, people are trained in such a way that the people who are in charge of you know, writing down when guards do security checks, which they never do, and that kind of stuff, you know, they're trained to write this thing down every half hour, whether it happens or not. And then the auditors come, they look at the books, and that's it. You know, so it's important to be able to get in and look when nobody else is looking. And, you know, with the border story as well, you know, I could have probably reached out to this militia, gone on some rides in their trucks. But what I was really interested in was what is their relationship with the Federal Border Patrol. And I was with them, you know, when they're meeting with the Border Patrol and they're meeting with somebody who is an intelligence agent from the Border Patrol who is, you know, telling us where to go to find people. He's telling us, you know, that he'll give the leaders unauthorized briefs even when they're not in Arizona. And, you know, these are the kind of things that you just, you can't see when people know that you're watching sometimes, and we have to be able to sometimes be there when people don't know that when people don't know we're watching. When it's, you know, a story that merits, you know, that kind of that has an issue of vital public interest. I just before I leave, I just want to say that, you know, this. Doing this story, especially the first story, the CCA story, at a time when this kind of thing had not been done for a long time, I don't think I could have done this story anywhere other than Mother Jones. And, you know, I think that that Mother Jones, you know, took a huge risk in this story. It cost a lot of money. Our editors, you know, later wrote about it, said that it cost $350,000 to do this story. We got $5,000 in advertising money. And, you know, and a lot of people read this story. It's not that, you know, it just slid by. But the model of, you know, kind of independent journalism is really important for this kind of work because it's really based on, you know, readers' investment. And people did invest after this story came out, and it did get paid for. But they did not take this story because they thought I was going to make a lot of money. You know, they put me on this story for a year and a half, and you know, 4 fact checkers, lawyers. It was a massive endeavor. So I feel really fortunate to have, you know, essentially landed my dream job at, you know, 34 years old. And you know, this is the kind of stuff, the kind of media we really need to support. Thanks.
an explanatory note about our final honoree. The Izzy Award doesn't normally honor documentary work, but the 4.5-hour series, America Divided, which is being seen now in community gatherings all across the country. It's so powerful that the Izzy judges thought we should make an exception this year. It examines the biggest issues of inequality in our society that journalists need to be examining, but few journalists are, especially in corporate media. The series uses well-known actors and artists as correspondents who question the powers that be, and they question them on issues like environmental racism, incarceration, discrimination in housing, discrimination in education, drug addiction, immigration, worker exploitation, 8 different stories. Here are a few excerpts that provide only a hint of the scope of this amazing series.
One short week after Van Dyke's murder charge, Superintendent Gary McCarthy is fired.
Top cop Gary McCarthy is forced to resign.
The former superintendent says he believes Mayor Rahm Emanuel made him the fall guy for the Laquan McDonald shooting.
Hey.
Thanks for coming through. How you doing today?
I'm doing good today.
Yeah.
But it's a day-by-day existence, right?
Yes, sir. So, man, I mean, obviously, you know, we're here to talk about a lot of stuff going on in Chicago. I really want to hear your perspective. At the core of it, what is the issue?
I don't want to sound defensive, you know what I'm saying? Because you got to realize where I'm coming from and what just happened to me. I just got held accountable for something that I didn't have any ability to do anything about. You know, the Laquan McDonald video is a terrible video. Police can do better, that's obvious, right? We know that. But I think that we have to do a better job of diagnosing what's going on. You know, last year in Chicago, there were 3,000 people shot. 3,000 people were shot. There were 19 police-related shootings. 0.0063% of the people shot in Chicago last year were shot by police officers. But what's the biggest problem in Chicago? It's the police. I don't think so.
Yeah, but the communities don't feel safe that the police are going to keep them safe.
You're describing something called legal cynicism. It has to do with the fact that they don't trust that bad guy, but they know that the police can't do anything about it, and there's no reason to trust the police. You know, you have to look at this through the prism of history. And if you go back 300, 400 years, it starts with slavery, which was written into the Constitution of the United States. And you move from slavery to black codes to segregation to Jim Crow. Now, who was it who was doing the enforcement of all of those racist policies? It was the white policeman.
Right.
So there's a narrative that's well-deserved. The anger that exists in some of the disenfranchised communities comes from a number of places. And the police are definitely part of that component, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But poverty, lack of opportunity, right? Lack of education, rampant narcotics, families getting broken up, all contribute to a community that doesn't trust the system.
Yeah.
Right? And the most visible component of that system is the police.
Yeah.
Right? You don't see a prosecutor every day. You don't see a judge. You don't see a sheriff.
Right.
You see a police officer on the street. But we're missing the iceberg, right? Yeah. Because only the tip of the iceberg is showing.
It's hard to believe. Chicago's former police superintendent just told me that the police don't have a race problem. America has a race problem. The police are only the face of it.
Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. didn't quite open the border. But as president, each did extend legal status to millions of undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. So how did we go from that to this?
Listen, we should enforce the law. How do we enforce the law? Yes, we should deport them. We should build a wall. We should triple the border patrol.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
I need to talk to someone who can explain the attitude shift. So I'm going to meet with Dan Stein, the head of a group called the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR. A lobbying group based in Washington, D.C. They believe we're letting too many people in, both illegals and legals. given where I've been, I decide to start with the babies.
You've used the term anchor babies. Can you tell me what you mean by that term?
It's an anchor. It's a grappling hook. It's an attachment. It's a foot in the door. And I don't understand why that's derogatory, by the way, but some people seem to feel it is. But it's descriptive of the fact that it provides a foot in the door.
You think people come to this country and then have the babies so that they won't get kicked out?
There are many, many reasons why people come to this country. Nobody comes to this country devoid of understanding or information about how U.S. law works.
I recently saw a clip of the 1980 presidential debate between George Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan, where they talked about immigration and spoke of undocumented immigrants in this country being good people, hardworking people. People that we should find more kindness and compassion. I mean, these are the words that came out of these two conservative heroes' mouths. What has changed so dramatically that between then and now?
It isn't fair to attribute border anarchy to compassion. It's not a compassionate position to say that anybody can just run into the country and be expected to be treated like everybody else.
The conversation around who these people are has gone from hardworking immigrants who are here to make a better life for themselves and for their children to something very, very different in this present day.
First of all, 1980 was a very long time ago, and I'm here to tell you that the American people have been incredibly hospitable, generous, and open in going through some of the biggest demographic changes in any nation in the history of the world. And here we are today, having a debate right now over whether or not the government even has the credibility to control our borders.
Okay, so the reality is that at the moment, there are 11 million or more undocumented immigrants living in this country. What is your wish for that 11 million population? What would you, if you had
some of them
your
can,
way...
Some of them could probably stay. Some of them will have to go home.
So are you saying they should be removed?
Well, not all at once, but there's a process by which you encourage people to leave. Some people would be put in deportation proceedings. Some people would go back home. Nothing about the law, nothing about Congress, nothing about the American people have ever said the way you immigrate here is to break the law and then wait around for the next amnesty program. It's not
the law. I guess we're at an impasse where I see refugees and people struggling to make a better life for their children. Dan Stein sees lawbreakers, pure and simple. But could it be that cut and dry?
I need to talk to someone. Chief Stelgis still refuses to meet with me, but I managed to track down the most powerful law enforcement official in the county. No one is charged with a crime here without the approval of State's Attorney Bernie McCabe's office.
Mr. McCabe, sir, how are you?
Okay.
Jesse Williams. Do you think that, in general, the criminal justice system in Pinellas is failing the kids?
Well, you'd have to ask the police, I guess.
Well, you don't have access to the arrest records?
I don't pay attention to... I don't look at the arrest records of those cases like my juvenile division does. I have 165 lawyers.
Sure. But your offices have a policy as to how to charge juveniles, right?
We're investigating cases every day, looking at what's appropriate to divert, what's not appropriate to divert, and making decisions.
So there's diversion, but there's also what charges you want to, how you want to consider,
for instance,
and they come into your office.
If it's a disrupting school function,
great.
Should we charge them with the felony of disrupting school function or the misdemeanor of disorderly conduct?
Or do you have to charge them?
No, we don't have to charge them. But if there's a case there, would it be responsible to just ignore it?
Would it be responsible to charge every single kid that comes to your office?
Don't charge
just because,
every single kid.
Well, we have stacks and stacks of arrest records for children that are getting arrested for things that happen in school that I remember as being school scuffles or mischief at school, right?
Well,
and you would as well.
And back when I was in school,
yeah.
You had corporal punishment, and I got paddled.
Sure. But you didn't get a charge that
no,
follows you
until
you were 35 years old.
No.
Okay. So if you're obviously aware of the alarming amount of arrests for kids in the school system, in this particular area, in this particular state, is that something in the water? What do we attribute that to? I mean, you're saying all that you guys are working so hard to defer.
Well, I think there's a cultural aspect to it that I don't understand. So,
what's that? Okay, there's a cultural aspect to the data around arrests?
No, what's going on in the schools that I don't understand.
Whose culture is that?
Societal culture.
Culture
in Pinellas County. I don't know.
Right, the culture of the people getting arrested.
I just think there's a cultural factor that I don't understand.
And to that point, we're trying to understand the culture of this office, right?
I'm not a social worker. I'm a prosecutor.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Accepting the award on behalf of America Divided, we have three executive producers, Sally Granitstein, Richard Rowley, Lucian Reed, and senior producer Rebecca Teitel. Come on up.
Okay, in the spirit of the collaborative nature of documentary filmmaking, all four of us are here to receive this, so we're going to speak very briefly. First of all, I just want to say what an incredible honor it is to receive this award and to share a stage with such amazing fellow journalists, and also a stage that has been shared by so many of my friends, heroes, and comrades in the past. To be completely brief, we're living in a very dangerous time, but a time that is also filled with exciting possibilities and potentials that some of which I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. There's been a breakdown in the narrative, the story about who we are as a country. And part of that has been driven by the massive growing inequality in this country. We're statistically more unequal now than we've been since the 1920s on the eve of the Great Depression, and that is a corrosive engine for producing instability and violence. And when you live in a media culture in which all of these transformations and the economic pain and the violence that you see is made incomprehensible to you, when it confronts you as a series of crises that don't make any sense, and the world is terrifying and you're alone, then there are political formations and identities that emerge in that kind of space that are terrifying. And I think we see some of those now. And so we need an independent media, the kind of independent media that I.F. Stone embodied, that the recipients of this award embody, and that this award itself reminds us that we're part of a history and a trajectory in a community of independent media makers who make sense of this world and of these systems and structures of violence that create the reality that we're in. And so the premise of America Divided is that we cannot understand these problems and issues in isolation. We cannot understand our own struggles in isolation, that too often we see them housed in issue silos by themselves. And we wove together stories around criminal justice, education, housing, health, environment, and immigration.
Labor.
Yeah. We wove these stories together because it is impossible to understand them in isolation. It is only when we hear the voices of these people ringing together that we can, come to imagine in this dangerous and exciting and unstable time a new kind of identity and a new kind of human empathy that can create a movement that I think could turn this from a moment of danger and fear into a moment of possibility.
Hi. It's a great honor, as everyone's been saying.
So a few years ago, my great colleagues and I decided to create a documentary series about inequality because we saw economic inequality as this corrosive, destabilizing force in our society. And a few months ago, I think that we saw the result, the political result of the corrosive and destabilizing effect of inequality and economic insecurity in people voting their anger and their xenophobia on the one hand, and other people really feeling alienated and not going to the polls. And of course, as Ari was pointing out, we had the voter suppression, which is covered in our series as well. And, you know, there is historical precedent for this kind of extreme political result after economic upheaval. Of course, you know, I'm talking about the 1930s in Germany, when you had a recent legacy of hyperinflation ending in 1933 in the election of Adolf Hitler, who was elected democratically. And it was definitely a very extreme and terrible political result. And when I was describing what I'd say to a colleague of mine a few minutes before the ceremony, he said, "Oh, you had to go there. You had to go to Hitler." You know, I think as anybody watching and listening to the White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer in the past few days can attest, you know, our society doesn't really have a very firm grasp on this history, this crucial history. You know, that history, I think, looms as important as ever. I just want to relate a story from my childhood that is bound up in this history. When I was around 4 years old, I would go around telling all the adults I came across the story of the three bears. And then when I got to the end, I would say, "And all the Jews died in the end." And so what that says to me is I had a very early exposure to this idea of genocide. And I think that I credit this early exposure to having a certain dedication to social justice and battling social injustice, and the recognition that, you know, it may not be my people, it may not be the Jews who are at risk in our society or at the greatest risk in our society right now, but if I don't stand up for others, then it could be me next. Also from early childhood, we were in West Orange, New Jersey when I was about 4 years old, and I remember an argument that my parents had with our across-the-street neighbors about the fact that a black family wanted to move onto our street. And I remember my parents arguing with our neighbors that this family should have every right to live where they wanted to live, you know, as Americans, as people. And it brings me to the series that we just made because this kind of discrimination, this kind of housing discrimination that I witnessed when I was four in the early 70s in New Jersey happens every single day all over the country. And one of our stories, in America Divided, we worked with an outfit called the Fair Housing Justice Center of New York, and we put a hidden camera on an African-American actor who went to an apartment in building in the Bronx and asked if there were any vacancies, and the landlord told him no. And then next, we mounted a hidden camera on our correspondent, the 93-year-old Norman Lear, who went to the same apartment building and got a completely different answer, that there were apartments available. This is called a housing test. I'm sure many of you have heard of that. It used to be something that was conducted by the federal government. The U.S. Justice Department used to conduct housing tests. They got out of that business many years ago. Now it's left to these nonprofits to do it. And, of course, I'm sure many of you are aware that the U.S. Justice Department conducted housing tests of properties owned by Donald Trump and his father, Fred Trump, and found a pattern of discrimination against African Americans, and that the Trumps settled the case. So now we have this same defendant in this case brought by the U.S. Justice Department for racist discrimination as the landlord in chief. And Ari Berman said Donald Trump is the greatest threat to democracy in our lifetimes. I think that seems undeniable, as does the notion to me that Trump is someone who has capitalized on this country's deep inequality and racial inequity, and also represents their perpetuation. So this is why I feel that our work on this series and that of Ari and Seth and Shane and the support of the Park Foundation and the Park Center is more important than ever. Thank you.
Good evening. I just wanted to, you know, obviously start by first thanking the Park Center and the Park Foundation and the folks at these awards who were kind enough to select us for this unprecedented award. I also wanted to thank, although they're not here, but I always do it whenever I can, all the people who participated in the series, all of the subjects, all of the experts, all of the organizations, everybody that made it possible. You know, we're just the storytellers, but it's their stories we're telling. I want to make sort of one point, which is to say, I know standing here looking down how important it seems to me, I realize looking down at our colleagues here, how important an independent media is, because in addition to all the people who made up our stories, the stories would not have happened without the hard work of all, in many cases, the print journalists who get there first. In my own case, one of the big episodes that I did was the North Carolina story, was at Galifianakis, and it's an investigation and a journey through the kind of corruption of the democratic process in North Carolina, my home state, which I feel very passionate about. And while I, you know, had a lot of inside information from all my family still living in North Carolina about what the hell is going on there, really, at the end of the day, the biggest person who tied it all together for me was Ari Berman. And, you know, without Ari's tireless work and the support of the Nation Institute and the fund, it wouldn't have been possible to tell the story that we told. And I mean that literally, because as we got through the process, we went and I did all my filming with Zach, and we went to North Carolina and met a bunch of amazing people and ran around the state and came back with hours of footage, and it was all going to be awesome. And then I got into the edit room and started to put it all together, and I was like, oh my God, half of this doesn't make any sense. Like, how am I going to explain all these super complicated ideas that we just didn't have the time to get when we were there? And I thought, I have to call Ari. And so I called Ari, and I explained to Ari. I was like, look, I need you to help me make sense of this stuff. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to get Zach, and I'm going to put you on Skype with Zach, and I'm going to send Rick Rowley to the Nation offices, and he's going to film you there, and I'm going to convince Zach that he needs to do one more shoot and hope he doesn't think I'm incompetent, that just that one more shoot. And I'm going to go to Canada where he was, and we're going to film on both sides of that. And we're going to have it where it's like you guys have three conversations. And those three conversations are going to be the wayposts through this whole thing where you explain to Zach each time he gets confused about where he needs to go next and what he needs to do. And it was, Ari was very generous with his time and agreed to do it, and brought not only his expertise, but his amazing comic talent and timing, which I really encourage you to go and watch the piece, if for nothing else than just their banter, which is amazing. And it really just, the whole, as soon as that happened and we brought all that material in, it just made the whole thing pop. And it would not have been possible if Ari had not spent years and years digging into all the stuff and just had it at the tips of his fingers, you know, just right there, and made it all crystal clear in a way that nobody else possibly could have. And it's because he's an independent journalist and he's given, you know, years of his life and dedication to telling the stories. And it made my job possible, really. It made that story possible. And I also it was just one other thing, and maybe this will come up later, some conversation, but there was another person who I believe stood on this stage, John Carlos Frey, at one point, and we've worked with him, Solly and I have worked with him, and, you know, I've just been blown away by his long-term commitment to the stories he tells, and I'm sure, you know, one of these days when we decide to turn our attention to private prisons, and I think we should, these gentlemen will be on we'll be calling them up to help us lift up those stories, you know, so really, what we do is we tell stories and we get into people's lives and we create this empathy with people by bringing them into your rooms and the television in a way that, you know, makes things very immediate and really, connects people together. But it wouldn't be possible without the hard work of the people that go before us. And that's, as I've said, these folks. So thank you very much.
So I will add a little bit to Lucian's thanks of the many people that we couldn't have done this without, whose hard work and sort of faith in the project were really helpful. And it's sort of ironic now to be accepting an award for a show called America Divided, because the fact of the matter is when this project first started a long, long time ago, one of the most controversial things about it was the title, and we got a lot of pushback in the early stages of reaching out to people, whether it was foundations or donors or celebrities, that people were really into the show, but they did not believe that America was divided. And they said, we love this, can we do it? But, you know, can we talk about the title? Is it possible to change the title? And so, you know, in early November, among the many emotional reactions after was this realization that, you know, everyone has sort of now come together around this idea that America is divided, and America has been divided. And a lot of the people that we spoke to and that we featured in the series, who you saw in some of these clips, knew that, but it's also very difficult to be the face of that. And a lot of the topics that we were discussing, whether it was Peter Sarsgaard talking to people who have heroin problems in Ohio, families in Pinellas, Florida, whose kids are failing, mothers in California who are doing their jobs because they're relying on a domestic worker to take care of their children while knowing that that domestic worker doesn't have benefits and isn't with their own kids. And it's very hard for people to sort of take that leap of faith and trust us to tell their stories and to be the face of it, of these issues that people didn't connect with otherwise. So I just want to thank, in addition to all of you guys, for giving us this tremendous honor, but the people who believed in us early on, whether through funding and also all the people who trusted us to tell their stories, who we now know more than ever that there's been a lot of backtracking, I think, on some of the progress that we were able to highlight. So it's a bittersweet time to be accepting this award, but everyone's work here, I think, gives us all faith that good can come of it, hopefully. So thank you.
I don't know about you, but I feel honored to be in the presence of these articulate journalists and filmmakers. The Park Center for Independent Media was set up to tell students that there is an alternative path if you're working in journalism and media, that there's an independent path. We provide internships for students to work at places like The Nation, Mother Jones, Democracy Now!, independent film production companies. And it's a thrill every year to be able to gather some of the real exceptional work. I want to give a couple shout-outs, and then we'll call this a meeting. WRFI Community Radio has been so important in this community. And they will be airing this broadcast on their radio show, and one of the great independent television networks, satellite TV, is called Free Speech TV, and this will be televised repeatedly on Free Speech TV. Let's hear it for them. And I want to thank you all for having participated in the 9th annual Izzy Awards ceremony. Thank you so much for supporting independent journalism. You guys want to all come up?